Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Spencer from Tulare with 8 years and 4 days.
Spencer, alcoholic. So, yeah. My name's Spencer, and my sobriety date is April 13th, 2011, and I've got a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. I've got a home group, the Tulare Saturday 2 p.m. meeting, so my boys are here, and I'm currently working on another fourth step, and I was told early on that if you could answer those four questions, you know, what's your sobriety date, who's your sponsor, what's your home group, what step you're working on, if you can answer those four questions, you're probably doing okay. And so that's how I'm doing today. I'm doing okay. And I'm sober today. You know, when I was asked to speak, I thought about my first few years of sobriety, and I got sober out in Boston, Massachusetts. And out there, home groups to go on what they call them commitments, and a bunch of people from a group will travel to a different group and then speak at that group, you know. And so I shared my story a lot in my first few years of sobriety, and then life got busier, and I started going to fewer of those meetings. And on my way over here, I was thinking, like, I can't remember the last time I had told, you know, what happened to me, so to speak, the, you know, experience, strength, and hope. You know, like in the fifth chapter, you know, a portion of how it works that a lot of meetings read, it says, you know, we share, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. To me, that's experience, strength, and hope. And I guess to briefly qualify, I had my first drink on June 17th of 1997. I was 18 years old. I had graduated high school. I was one of those kids that had two alcoholic parents, and so I was never going to drink. I didn't like what it did to my parents. I didn't like seeing what alcohol did to people in general. And I didn't have any compassion for it. I was a real prick about it, basically. Like, I thought I was better than all y'all that drank. And then when I was 18 years old, right after I graduated high school, I found out that my girlfriend of a couple of years had cheated on me. And for the first time in my life, I had a bunch of feelings that I couldn't deal with. You know, I was very stoic, and, I mean, all throughout, you know, most of my youth, I was in heavy metal bands and hockey teams, and you know, in college, I was in a fraternity. I was basically in groups of assholes all the time, and I was, you know, I was in the top five at least in all of them. You know, I was a real piece of work, just a real gem to be around, a lot of fun, and so that's how I knew how to show love, so to speak, was to just be sarcastic, to insult you. But then say, oh, I'll just get in and slap you on the back really hard. And just, you know, that was just kind of how I grew up. And I didn't realize that that's not what love is. You know, I learned love in these rooms. The, you know, the first time I ever went to an AA meeting, I'd only been drinking about 3.5 years. I had gone out to the bar with my buddy. He was driving. He got pulled over, but I went to jail because I decided I was going to get out and tell the cop how to do his job. And I ended up hogtied in the back of the cruiser. And so, you know, so a few months later, when I'm going before the judge, you know, I like to say that I got to my first AA meeting, you know, through my higher power, who at the time I chose to call Your Honor. And I went before the judge on these, you know, assaulting officer charges, and She's asking me straight up, like, do you think you have a problem drinking? And I had no problem saying yes. I was 21, 22 years old, something like that at the time. I said, yeah, I have a problem drinking. Like, I can't drink enough. Like, where's my booze? And she said, all right, well, how about you go to 20 AA meetings? I was like, all right. And, you know, what's my fine? How much, you know, just like, just go to 20 AA meetings. That's it. And I had 6 months to do it. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, that's fantastic. So I found this meeting that was like right after work, right by my place, Monday through Friday. So I just started going. It's like a 5:30 meeting, 5:30, 6:30. I was living in Salt Lake City at the time. And I started going to these meetings. And I actually didn't drink for those, you know, I just said, I'm not going to wait 6 months to do this. I'm just going to get this taken care of. I'm going to go for, you know, Monday through Friday for 4 weeks, get it done, and so I don't have to worry about it anymore. So I started going to these meetings, and I realized that I would go to these meetings, people would share about their feelings, people were nice to each other, people were honest with each other, and when I would leave that meeting, I didn't want to drink. And I didn't know what that was like. You know, wanting to drink was, that's how I lived my life. That was getting up in the morning. I wanted to drink. And so I realized that I at the time, I wouldn't have called myself like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, the requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I didn't want to stop drinking. But I was very interested in seeing what nice people were like. I wanted to see how nice people treated each other in just an everyday setting. These people weren't insulting each other. They weren't, you know, ragging on each other. They weren't judging each other. They were just at the meeting to get, you know, what I've come to realize is, you know, our medicine for people like myself who are alcoholic. And, you know, and unfortunately, I mean, I did go stoned to one of the meetings, and I do not recommend that. And God bless, if anybody here is stoned or drunk or on PCP, I don't give a shit. Like, I don't think anybody, like, God bless you for being here. You, it doesn't matter. I swear to you. Like, but I sat in the back, and I was like, fuck, everybody knows. You know? Oh, it was a night. It was so dumb. So yeah, I don't recommend going baked to an AA meeting. That's a bummer. But then, you know, at the end, on like my 20th meeting, I you know, I got up, I got a 30-day chip because I'm a liar. And then I went to the bar. You know, then I went to the bar to hang out with my fraternity brothers and showed them all my chip and got super drunk. And unfortunately, I didn't make it back for another 9 years. And those 9 years got rough. You know, I tried a lot of different things to try to stop drinking. You know, one of those things was heroin. You know, like, I was like, oh, maybe I'll do heroin to see if that'll help me stop drinking. And I didn't get arrested when I did heroin. I just, I didn't do nothing. I didn't really do anything. But yeah, you know, and every time I hear, you know, I guess these days in Alcoholics Anonymous, people are getting uptight about separating the drugs from the drinks and all that noise. And unfortunately, it sounds like the people that want to separate that haven't read the big book, because the big book talks about sedatives and morphine and all that stuff a lot. So I'm talking about like what Bill wrote, what Bob wrote. So yeah, I have a desire to stop drinking, so I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did all the condiments. I I dressed that burger up, but at the end of the day, I started with booze and I ended with booze. And in the end, I could not stop drinking booze. So I really identify as an alcoholic. I've been to other meetings, but I choose to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because that was the one thing that I couldn't stop doing by myself. And Alcoholics Anonymous is where I found God. Alcoholics Anonymous is where I, you know, they call them birthdays. Out back east, they know that we call them anniversaries, but out here we call them birthdays. And I like that. I like that a lot. Because, yeah, it didn't feel like I was doing much living before that. And so, you know, like I said, in those 9 years, it got pretty dark in between meetings. And I was living in Salt Lake City at the time. I was 32 years old. I used to, you know, I was a semi-professional musician for a while. At the time, I hadn't been on stage in about a year. I wasn't currently playing any music. I wasn't working. My parents were taking care of me. My mom was giving me a lot of money for drugs and booze. It was a bad living situation. Like I had like a weird, you know, that nice summer gray green color, you know, for the beach. But no, it was bad. And so I freaked out, and I packed up, you know, my mom's car that she had given me, and decided I was going to drive out to Boston, Massachusetts, to live with the woman that was soon to become my ex-girlfriend. But and I brought my drums with me, and I brought some, you know, music, and I just, as soon as I got there, like, those drums never left their cases. Those drums sat in the living room and watched me drink for about 6 months, and the cops were getting called. I found this little, you know, little bodega, they call them out there, a little convenience store that had these, they bottled their own vodka, $10 a half gallon. And, man, God bless them. Because Ruggiero's on Washington Street in Jamaica Plain. And I will always be grateful to those guys because they got me sober, basically. You know, because it didn't take too long before, you know, when the cops kept coming, it didn't take very long for me to get an attitude with one of them, and ended up with 7 more assaulting officer charges. And I had this, you know, my court date, and it was coming up. And prior to that, maybe a couple weeks before, I decided, like, I'm going to try not drinking. Let's see what this is like. So I went about 2 weeks without drinking. And then I went to lunch with my, you know, girlfriend, who we were still together. And, you know, I drank pink wine out of boxes and natural light through funnels. And, you know, like, I'm not a classy drinker, right? So we go to this super expensive restaurant on the pier in downtown Boston. You know, I'm using my parents' money. And I see on the menu there's this macadamia crusted mahi frangelico sauce, right? So I'm like, ooh, I'm going to get me a drink with some frangelico in it, like, because I'm fancy. And I, you know, I ate my lunch, and I mean, it's a Tuesday, like, you know, and I drank half the drink, and that was it. And then, you know, we left. And when we left that restaurant, I felt like I was the cool, I felt so proud of myself that I didn't finish the drink. Because I couldn't be alcoholic if I didn't finish the drink at lunch on a Tuesday, you know, my joblessness. Like, I called my mom. I called my brother. Like, I'm like, look, I just had half the drink. That's it. And they're like, wait, way to go, Spence. Like, that's great. And so I went and I celebrated that evening with a bottle of Southern Comfort and then a bottle of Captain Morgan's. And you know, in Bill's story, at one point he says, you know, that was the beginning of my last debauch. Because I think about that. And that little celebration ended with like about a 5-day mostly blackout, little brown pieces here and there where I could remember. And I tried to kill myself. I got to a point where I didn't see any point in living the life I was living anymore. And so I had got about 2 gallons of vodka, and I was just going to drink until I died. So that was the plan. And God saw fit to intervene. The woman I was living with, you know, she, after about a day and a half of pure blackout, like, she started pouring some water in the vodka. And so instead of, you know, fulfilling my plan, which was suicide, I came to. And that was April 12th. And I remember thinking, one of the little glimpses, you know, little memory that I have of those, you know, 3 or 4 days before that, I remember lining up those shots in the kitchen and just saying, I'm going to do this until I die. And I'd never been suicidal before. I had never, ever in my life recall ever thinking so selfishly. Like, I wasn't thinking about what that would do to my mom, or my dad, my brother, my sister. I wasn't thinking about anyone. I just didn't think I could handle the situation that I had put myself in anymore. And so I was going to take myself out. And so coming out of that blackout and remembering that feeling, I got very, very scared. And they talk about that in the big book, you know, like you're in that jumping off place. You know, I've been beaten into that state of reasonableness they talk about. Like, I had a genuine fear. And so that, you know, I'm looking at my phone and it's April 12th. I have my, you know, my PO date. You know, for those of you who aren't criminals, that's probation officer. I had to go meet with my PO the next morning, right? And so that next morning, like, at the time, I weighed about 300 pounds. I was beet red, hungover. I hadn't shaved or cut my hair in a long time. And I was still reeking of booze when I went down to the West Roxbury Courthouse, which is, you know, South Boston. And I never want to forget the look of pity that my probation officer had when I stepped into her office. She's looking at this dude who has just given up on life, basically. And, you know, she starts asking me all these questions, and I'm straight up lying to her about everything. Like, you ever done drugs? Nope. You know, like, but when she asked me how much I drank, I told her the truth. And I know now that that wasn't me, that was God. Because I didn't tell the truth, you know. But I told her how much I drank, and she asked me a couple of really important questions. She said, you know, is there any correlation between when you drink and when you get in trouble? The only stipulations of my probation were that I don't get in trouble for 18 months, and that I don't get these 7 felony assault charges, you know, assaulting officer charges, which are not great. So she said, you know, is there any correlation between when you drink and when, you know, you get in trouble? I said, yes. Yeah, 100%. Like, I didn't get arrested every single time I drank, but every single time I'd been arrested, which was, you know, a dozen times in a dozen states from New York to California, I'd been drinking. I'd never been arrested sober. So she dropped the big one on me. She said, have you ever thought about stopping? And, you know, like I said, I was just beat up enough. I was hungover enough. I had been through enough pain. I was scared enough with the attempted suicide. I was in the right place to take that suggestion. You know, she's like, you ever thought about stopping? I was like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. She said, you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, yeah, I did. I went like 9 years ago. I remember those meetings. Those people were nice to each other. They didn't drink. They didn't need to intoxicate themselves just to get through a day of life. And so I, you know, she gave me a meeting list book. And I was just telling Justin, thank you guys for your service, by the way, and thank everybody for who set up or coffee and all that stuff. God bless you guys, because you guys are saving lives. You know, I need you guys. And but anyway, she gave me this meeting list book, and then in Boston, there are 2,300 meetings a week in the area. Like, you know, from a 45-minute radius, 2,300 meetings a week. So I had this big book in my back pocket. And so that was the 13th. So the next day, I went to my first meeting. And, you know, I have been sober since, and that was 8 years ago. And I get to this meeting, and everyone's talking to each other, and they're shaking hands and they're smiling, and I'm just like, it's not anonymous. They know each other. Like, what the hell is going on here? I was very confused. It's clearly very intoxicated. I was about 2 days sober at that point. But I got up, and I'm listening to this guy. They like I said, they have speakers that talk throughout the meeting, and there's this guy talking. And he's talking about how he had a lot of alcoholics in his family, and how he came home one day to a bunch of cop cars because his 30-something-year-old older brother had drank himself to death with vodka, had an esophageal hemorrhage, and died. And he talked about what that did to his family, to himself, to his mother and father, to his brothers and sisters. He basically sat there and told me what I had almost done to my family just two nights prior. And so I got up, you know, they have a little break in the meeting, and I got up and I'm talking to him, and I'm explaining my situation to him, and he's listening, and I'm crying my eyes out at him, and he's like, "All right, so where are you going tomorrow?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "What meeting are you going to tomorrow?" He's like, "Well, there's a Faulkner Hospital, Jamaica Plain." I said, "Okay." And that ended up being my home group for 2 years. I was a bookie of that group. I was the treasurer of that group. I met my sponsor at that meeting, my first sponsor. Like, the way I look at the way my life is laid out, I can't help but believe in God. Like, I was a militant atheist for 30 years. Like, I was going to fight you if you believed in God, basically. Like, I was not fun to talk to about it. And I realized the way that events played themselves out, that was divine. There's a higher power working in my life, and I know that today. You know, and so, like I was saying, you know, the cops were getting called back home, and so just because I got sober doesn't mean that, like, things were great with my, you know, ex at the time, you know, my girlfriend at the time. And so that next Saturday, so I'd been sober 3 days at that point, and so we're fighting in the morning, and instead of walking down to Ruggiero's to buy that half gallon, I pulled out that meeting list, and it had just these tons of meetings and tons of neighborhoods, and I'm looking and I'm thinking, okay, I don't even know how to read this, but I notice I start to see some familiar names, and I see that I'm on Washington Street, Ruggiero's is on Washington Street, it's like 9:50 in the morning, and I see that there's a meeting at 10 in the morning right here, in this building, next door to Ruggiero's. So I'm like, no fucking way. Like, what? And so I go to that meeting and I meet, you know, people. Like, I'm crying my eyes out in the break, and this tiny little hippie girl walks over, gives me this big hug, says, "You're gonna be all right, we're gonna come pick you up, we're gonna take you to a meeting in Quincy tomorrow or tonight." I'm like, "All right, I guess we're going to a meeting tonight." And so I go to this meeting, there's 200 people, and people are sharing about alcoholism. I'm just crying the whole time. I cried for about every day for about a year and a half. And if you're emotional, that's fine. You know, like, we don't get great. That's awesome. Like, I'm trying not to cry right now, you know, because I'm 8 years sober now. So I'm wrong. But, man, I could not talk at a meeting without crying for almost 2 years. And I feel like that's progress. You know, we say it's progress, not perfection around here. Like, I can get through some meetings without crying these days. And, you know, I'm an emotional cat, whatever. But, at that meeting, they announced newcomers, just like y'all, you know, and God bless all the newcomers. Thank you for having the courage to come up here and stand up. Because after that, at that meeting, I was 3 days, four days sober, whatever. I got like a dozen numbers that night, right? And so that next morning, of course, my girlfriend and I are fighting again. Like, it's still a day. And I didn't have a miracle meeting that was right next to where I buy my booze. But I had 12 numbers in my phone. And I called those numbers, and six of them answered. So I spent that morning talking to people about alcoholism. You know, and like I said, that first Friday, I met, you know, the next day was April 17th. And I brought this with me, because this is my big book, bookmark. And it says April 17th, 2011 on it. Because this is a bus ticket, or a subway ticket from Boston. Because that next Sunday, I needed a meeting, and so I went down to the subway, and I just got on the train and went to this random 2 p.m. meeting. And it was in, like, a laundry room of an apartment complex. It was very strange. And there were two people there that I finally found when I showed up. And a few more people filtered in. And they do raffles for literature at every meeting out there. And so I get there, and I see this guy walk in, and I realize it was the guy that had given me my 24-hour chip at that first meeting I went to a couple of days before, right? And he recognized me, and he came and sat and talked to me at the break, and he says, "Do you have a big book?" I said, "I don't." He said, "Well, I'm going to win the raffle, so I'll give you the big book." I'm like, all right. So one of the ladies comes around and she gives me like 25, 30 tickets or whatever. She gives everybody else one, right? And they're going to, you know, and I'm thinking like, he didn't say I was going to win the raffle. He said he was going to win the raffle. So he's got his little one ticket. And they're passing the hat and there's the whole thing. And this guy, if they planned this, God bless him, because it was good. Because I wasn't looking at any of my tickets. I was staring at his ticket. Because this other dude grabs a hat, pulls a number out, reads his number. And I'm just like, he just doesn't even, he just reaches over, hands me a big book. Shit me out. And so for the next 6 months, like I would, you know, and then if no one wins the raffle, like if people leave or whatever, they give the book to a newcomer. And so for the next 6 months, like I was the newcomer. I got every single book that you can get. I have, you know, the big book, the 12 and 12, Pass It On, you know, Dr. Bob and the good old timers. Like I got AA Comes of Age, and I read all those books. You know, I dove in. Like when I used hard, and when I did AA hard for a very long time. You know, that sponsor, he got me into some group step work for a little bit, but after about a year, I realized that wasn't quite enough for me. So I got with a guy that would sit down with me one-on-one and take me through the book and do a thorough working of our 12 steps. And that's when it started to get really fun for me, I think, because... You know, up until that point, I didn't have to work. Like, my parents were taking care of me at the time. I didn't have, you know, I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a job for a couple of years. Like, I could spend all my time going to meetings, trying to help newcomers, going on commitments, you know, speaking at, you know, rehabs and stuff like that. Like, I was very blessed to be in that position. But, you know, like I said, after about a year plus, when I started working with my sponsor, you know, directly out of the big book, in a pretty organized way, that's when I started to really get to look at me, you know, my defects. And, wow, that's fun. And, but I am eternally grateful for that, because I actually have the ability to change now. I can grow as a person because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, before, like, I was sober, and it was great, But I wasn't really growing personally. And when I started getting into the step work with a sponsor, I started realizing that I can be the person that I believe God wants me to be. And just so you know, when I say God, I don't know what I'm talking about. I have absolutely no idea. And one of my first sponsors, my second sponsor, the guy that took me through the book one-on-one, he made it very clear. He's like, look, AA does not care what you think. That's just how it goes. Like, whatever you think about God, fantastic. And it says it right there in Bill's story, you know, like, why don't you choose something that works for you? That's what Abby said to him. And up until that point, I was having none of God, no, none of it. And my views didn't change. All that happened was my view opened up. And now it can all come in now. I can, you know, finally see the sunlight of the Spirit that they talk about. So I pray every day. I do a third step prayer. I do a seventh step prayer. I try to pray as often as I can. And I have no idea who or what I am talking to. And it doesn't matter. That's the beautiful thing, is it's not what it's about, you know. It's about the willingness for me. And I learned that, you know, through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. As the years have gone by, you know, like I was an analytical chemist for 13 years. Like I'm a very scientific person, and so when they told me to do 90 and 90, you know, I had this little day planner, and so I was writing down my meetings, I was counting them out, right? And I kind of never stopped. So this is my 1,290th meeting. In my first year, I went to 450 meetings, and this past year I went to 60. And I was thinking, you know, that's just how life goes. My wife's, a doctor. She's doing her intern year, and we have two kids, a 4-year-old and a 4-month-old, and I'm a stay-at-home dad. So I don't have a ton of time, but I have always had a sponsor. I've always tried to go to at least a meeting a week, and not only, you know, for a few years there, I had a sponsor kind of in name only. when I got to the valley, I actually met a dude at a meeting. Y'all might know him over there. I heard him talking at a meeting, and just the way he was kind of describing his own crazy, I was like, oh, I can relate to this guy. And so I'm able to actually do work with a sponsor. You know, like, so it's not only important to have a sponsor. I think it's important to do work with your sponsor, because as far as I know, that's the point. So, like, when I sponsor guys, and I've been blessed enough to be able to work with a few guys over the years, you know, we have these tools. We have an opportunity to change. We have an opportunity to not be the guy that I brought in. Like, if I was still the guy that walked in the door 8 years ago, you know, I might still be clean and sober, but, like, I certainly wouldn't have a wife. I wouldn't have kids. I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in to be able to help other people. Because no one would want what I have, you know. I believe that through, you know, the physical sobriety is fantastic. And then, you know, you can kind of sober up mentally a little bit. But once you get into that spiritual groove, like, you can start putting out that energy that says, like, hey, you know, this is what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for you. Any one of you. You know, and because it did it for me. And, like, I have a buddy in Salt Lake that got sober about 3 or 4 years ago now. And when he was trying to get sober, he called me, and he's like, you know what I tell myself when I go to meetings now? I'm like, what? He's like, if Spencer can get sober, then I can get sober. I thought, man, if that's what works for you, man, that's awesome. Because, yeah, I did not, no one thought I was going to live, you know. And when I was talking about how I, you know, I had almost committed suicide, I thought, you know, I don't want my mom to get that phone call. That was the thought that goes through my mind. I don't want my mom to get that phone call. And last July, I actually got that phone call about my mom. And she was one of us. And I tried to get her to go to meetings. And that's just not how it worked out for her. And because I was sober, and because I'd been in recovery, the thought of drinking did not even cross my mind when I lost my mom. Like, it didn't even occur to me that that's what I used to drink over all the time, stuff like that. And that was the most traumatic thing that had ever happened to me. And my first thought was, okay, I'm going to talk to my dad. Like, how can I be of service? How can I show up today? Like, when, you know, when I was asked to speak at this meeting, I thought, I can't leave the house past 5 p.m. That's not a thing. Is that what? I take care of the kids and the wife. And the... But Alcoholics Anonymous has never said no to me. So I can't say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember walking home from that very first meeting, you know, in Jamaica Plain, at a little place called the Agassiz School on Center Street. And I was walking home, and I had this feeling, this very visceral feeling. I thought, maybe I don't have to do this anymore. I just never want to forget that, because it's, you know, it's been a few years now. But it was also made very clear to me very early on from my first sponsor that monster, that guy inside that used to love to drink and do all sorts of stuff and get arrested, he's not gone. Like, he's very much still right here. He's one drink away. Because if I pick up that drink, last time I drank, I tried to kill myself. I have absolutely no idea what I'll try to do this time. And usually if I fail at something the first time, I usually do it the next time. And that scares me. Because now I have a little 4-year-old and a little 4-month-old. And I do not want them to grow up without a father. And I know that if I pick up that drink, you know, it's over. But it's not, you know, but I'm not immune. I'll never be immune. I have to keep doing the do. You know, we got our legacies of recovery, our legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous: recovery, unity, and service. It says it on the chips and everything. You know, recovery is the steps. That's how we stay personally sober. Unity, that's the meetings. That's our fellowship. That's how, you know, that's where the traditions come in. And then we got our service, you know. And if you're serious about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I would suggest trying to get into service, you know, because if you read the concepts, they can seem a bit convoluted and a little wordy, But it's basically the whole point of all of them, as far as I'm concerned, is to make sure that Alcoholics Anonymous never becomes about a government, because it's about service. Like a lot of things that used to be service positions in our government type things have become positions of power. That's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's 100% about service. And if I, you know, can leave you guys with anything today, it's that, you know, hold on to that chip. You know, if you're new, like I got, like they give away all the chips, 1 through 11, not just 1, 2, 3, 6, 9, no, like we give all of them away. Like out in Boston, like some of my meetings didn't have those, so I traveled to find the 4 and the 5, the 7 and the 8, you know. I went to the general service office and got a couple, actually. I was like, nope, I want these. Because that little piece of plastic saved my life so many times. Like, I suggest, you know, grab those medallions. If you're new and you don't know people, get a phone number. Call that phone number. So many numbers. Every phone number I've ever gotten, I've called at least once. Even if it was just to say thank you for your number. You know? Thank you for talking to me after that meeting. Some of those people whose numbers I called the next day, I've been in some of their weddings. I've been on stage with some of them. You know, like I've traveled the country with some of them. One of those ladies turned into my wife. So, you know, and we've got a couple little kids to show for it. You know, she's been sober 15 years, and I invited her to my, you know, my one-year anniversary at the time, and she said, no, thanks. But I kept going. I kept persisting. So, yeah, we're married now and everything, but it's a trip. I'm thinking, because I always think about this around April, because, you know, this is when it all happened. Like I said, this little subway ticket says April 17th, 2011 on it. And trips me out. And so, you know, go to meetings, get a sponsor, get the literature, take suggestions. Don't get into a relationship for the first year. My suggestion. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. You know, I will never be able to repay what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, but all I can do is show up. You know, I can make myself available. So when I'm asked to speak, I say yes. And I'm eternally grateful to be alive today. So I know you guys can have a meeting without me, but I cannot have one without you. So God bless y'all.
We give him another.